Live from CAP Radio in Sacramento, this is Insight. I'm your host, Vicky Gonzalez. What do you tell people from out of town about Sacramento? Would you recommend the city as a great place to live? For those newly planted in Sacramento, how long do you plan on staying? 5 years, maybe more? From the conditions of the streets to safety, homelessness, overall quality of life, this is your chance to weigh in and let the city know what you like, what you don't like, and what needs attention. Since 2018, the city of Sacramento has been asking people who live here what they think in an annual survey, and the 2023 version just launched. Sacramento City Auditor Jorge Oseguera is here to walk us through the process, as his office is the one who administers the survey and analyzes all the data. Thanks for being here, Jorge.
Thank you for the invitation, Vicky.
So before we get into the survey, let's just get some context into what the city auditor does for the city of Sacramento, someone like yourself.
Great. Well, thank you again for the invite. In the city of Sacramento, we do have an independent auditor who reports directly to the mayor and city council. And so we are separate from management, and our purpose is to audit the city's operations and report back on opportunities to operate more efficiently or effectively, to identify opportunities to maybe increase revenues and to comply with policies, procedures, laws, and regulations. And so in essence, we independently review how the city is doing, what it does, and report back independently to the mayor and city council on how those things can be improved.
You've been with the auditor's office for more than a decade. Did you always envision you would be an auditor?
No. I think many people in this profession stumble upon this as a career, and that was definitely the case with me. I went to public policy school, received my master's in public administration, and really didn't have auditing on my radar as a career choice. But as luck would have it, I did end up identifying an opportunity to begin doing this line of work in the city of San Jose. And once I started doing it, I really grew to love it. And I've been doing it ever since. It is now 23 years in auditing. And one of the things that I really enjoy about this profession and about this line of work is that we get to identify opportunities for improvement and actually see those improvements take shape. And that can be a very rewarding challenge and experience.
Yeah, I can totally see that. Given that this survey started back in 2018, what prompted this survey? Why did it start?
Well, as I mentioned earlier, I did have almost a decade of experience in the city of San Jose, and that was one of the tools that the city of San Jose used in gauging how the community perceived the level of service that they were receiving from their local government. And I thought that implementing that tool here in the city of Sacramento would also be beneficial and provide some unique insight into where the community's priorities are and where we might have opportunities for improvement that may not be obvious to us that are providing the services.
You know, given that you've had several surveys in the past from 2018 to 2022, have there been some consistent themes or topics that stand out to you about residents what they're more engaged with?
Sure. We have a very engaged community is something that definitely stands out from the survey. And as such, you know, I think this survey is a very useful tool. Themes that consistently come up as being of high priority to our community are the economy, the availability of affordable housing, and also having a community that is safe and that feels safe and that I think values public safety as a whole.
Mm. I was looking at last year's results. It's like 177 pages. It's very robust. So what goes into crafting these questions, collecting the data and analyzing it and putting it into a report of this scale?
Well, one of the reasons why I find this particular tool so useful is because you can survey a community and get results, but often it's difficult to put the results into context. And so if, for example, we're looking at the public sentiment regarding the importance of the economy, if 80% of the residents feel that, you know, emphasizing our efforts on the economy is important, what does that mean? Is that good? Is that bad? Is that kind of in line with similar communities? And without having some additional information to compare it to, it's difficult to gauge whether that's good, bad, or indifferent. This survey gives us not only the ability to get that feedback directly from our community in a way that is statistically significant and reliable, but it also gives us the ability to compare ourselves to other similar communities. And so in doing this survey, not only do we get the results for us, but the same questions are being asked of communities across the country. And we have identified for our comparison purposes, communities that are of approximately 500,000 residents to 5 million residents to compare to, so that it's more similar to the types of issues and challenges that a larger city like the city of Sacramento would have. And so not only do you get a sense of how the city feels about a particular issue, but is that similar to other communities that are like ours, or are we doing better, or maybe is that an opportunity for improvement?
The fact that, you know, the survey doesn't just exist in a vacuum, it actually produces results, and you get to see that as the auditor. Who uses this information and the results from the surveys to shape policy?
Well, that's one of the things that I think our office really emphasizes, is that our office is very transparent. The results of our reports, not only in regards to the community survey, but in regards to our audits and any other research and analysis that we do, is publicly available. And so definitely we want the public to be able to use this information, learn from it, advocate based on their areas of interest or their perceptions of where, you know, communities need improvements, and communicate with our elected officials, with our city officials on what are the things that are important to them. But obviously, not only does the public receive this information, we present this information in a public session to the mayor and city council. We provide this information to management and the entire executive team. It is publicly available. And so we have a robust discussion regarding the results of the survey, where we see, you know, some patterns that we might want to highlight. And then management can leverage that information to determine whether they feel like there are changes that they can make to maybe make improvements in a particular area where a deficiency was highlighted.
Hmm. Do you ask the same questions year over year, or do they change? Do you curate them depending on what the issues are of the time?
For the most part, the questions are consistent. That is done so that we can trend this over time. If the questions were constantly changing, then we wouldn't have that available to us as something that we could trend. But as we learn and as things change, new questions sometimes are added, or tweaks are sometimes made to the survey. And so if you are one of those individuals that's just very interested in data and you pour through this information, you'll see that there are some questions that only have, for example, two data points. And that's usually because that was a question that was new, and therefore you don't have the multiple years of data points to compare to.
So given that there is some consistency and you're now going on your sixth year of this survey, what have some major shifts or trends been? I mean, I would imagine when you think of quality of life, cost of living, you think of affordability, employment opportunities, a sense of safety. And then I think there's those more, you know, kind of, I don't know, maybe qualitative things like, you know, parks and access to the outdoors. You know, how have you seen the responses evolve over the years?
You know, it's a very good question, and one that's difficult to answer in terms of what's causing some of the changes in the patterns that we're seeing. And the obvious one that I think everyone can kind of understand is that, you know, we recently went through a pandemic. And it is unclear how that pandemic may have impacted public sentiment. But I think what's important and why we continue to do this survey is to be able to continue to track that data and that information over time to see if there are patterns that are emerging that cause us to reconsider how we provide a particular type of service. And something that I know is critically important to our city's management and to the mayor and city council is to constantly gauge and address the community's priorities. And this is one of those tools that I think the city can leverage to, with a statistical level of confidence, gauge where those priorities are. This survey also provides us the opportunity to insert some custom questions that are unique just to the city of Sacramento. And so with that ability, we have designed a series of questions that are targeted to gauge the community's level of priority when it comes to how the city utilizes its limited Measure U resources. And so I think this is now the second or third year in a row that we were asking those questions regarding specifically how the community would like us to use those resources that are generated through the Measure U. And we've been gauging that obviously for a couple of years, and it's something that we want to keep close tabs on so that if the community shifts in terms of its priorities, then the council and management can make adjustments as necessary.
You're listening to Insight here on CAP Radio. And if you're just joining us, we're talking with Sacramento City Auditor Jorge Oseguera about the city's annual survey that is now available for residents. Okay, so when it comes to this year's survey, it just launched. You have the month of November to take part in it. What are some of the questions that you're asking?
We're asking questions about the economy, questions about quality of life, governance, obviously, the different types of services that the city provides in terms of parks, public safety, police, fire, the whole gamut. And it is useful to gather this information so that, again, we can assess where it is that the city stands in terms of the community's satisfaction with those services, and if necessary, so that we can make improvements where needed.
And this is online, correct? So there's a link that someone can click. In terms of other accessibility and potential barriers, you know, is it also in different languages?
It is in different languages. It is available in a broad range of languages, and that can be selected when you go online to fill out the survey. The survey, though, I want to distinguish there. It's actually provided in two formats. One is a paper copy that is sent by mail to a statistical sample of residents. Over 7,500 surveys went out to those individuals. It's a random sample, and it is weighted, and the results, if we get enough people to respond, is statistically significant at 95% confidence and a 4% error rate is what we've been shooting for in prior years. The open survey is not statistically significant, but we want as many people in our community to participate. And so we also simultaneously run an open survey for anyone in our community to be able to participate. And so for those that did not receive the paper version, they can go onto the city's website at www.cityofsacramento.gov. and fill out the survey themselves so that their voice can be heard. And we want as many of our community's voices to be heard in this exercise so that we get as clear of a picture of where the community stands in regards to how it feels our service is being delivered and where we might have opportunities for improvement.
And we have a link on our Insight page as well to make it easy to
Fantastic.
Just click and go. Finally, Jorge, when are the results available?
The results will be available probably in about March of 2024, and we'll be presenting that information to the mayor and city council in one of those public sessions, and it'll also be available on our website. On our website, if anyone is curious, you can also see any of the four prior community surveys that we've conducted and sort through all that information and get a sense of what types of questions you can anticipate if you do choose to participate.
Jorge, thank you so much.
You're welcome. It's a pleasure.
It is a pleasure to have you here. Thank you for taking the time and talking to us about this important survey. Jorge Oseguera is the auditor for the City of Sacramento, and we have a link to the community survey on our Insight page. You're listening to Insight on your NPR station, CAP Radio. I'm Vicky Gonzalez. You're listening to Insight here on CAP Radio. I'm your host, Vicky Gonzalez. In March of 2020, the pandemic shut California down, and millions of people found themselves scrambling to file for unemployment benefits. But California's job safety net, administered by the Employment Development Department, or EDD, buckled under the stress. Tens of billions of dollars in fraud was lost. Scammers had an easier time getting signed up than real workers, and millions of legitimate claims were frozen or denied. A year-long investigation from CalMatters, a nonprofit newsroom that partners with public media stations across the state, reveals how existing faults and delayed reforms rendered EDD's outdated unemployment system vulnerable and left workers waiting weeks or months for benefits that they desperately needed. And in some tragic cases, the help arrived too late. Lauren Hepler is an investigative reporter for CalMatters who has covered the ongoing issues and breakdowns in pandemic unemployment programs. She joins us with more about her findings and how EDD is trying to overhaul its battered systems. Welcome back to Insight, Lauren.
Thanks for having me, Vicky.
So you last joined us on Insight in May, and you shared your reporting about why California's EDD challenges, they're not over yet. So 6 months later, you've published a series of investigative reports detailing how things went wrong and the devastating consequences for millions of Californians. So the big reporter's notebook picture, what went into this latest series?
Yeah. So, I mean, the idea was really, you know, now that it's hard to believe, but it's been 3.5 years since the first COVID shutdown. So we wanted to take a step back. We requested several thousand pages of state contracts, of internal emails and communications, financial records, to just try to get a handle on, as the dust settles, what really went wrong during the pandemic, because we know this was an issue both in California and other states. So what specifically went wrong here? What's been fixed since? And, you know, could any of this ultimately happen again?
So is this a forensic look back solely, or does your investigation also highlight problems that still exist today?
Both. Unfortunately, we found that several of the key differences between California and other states, like one example being that California is one of only three states in the U.S. that doesn't offer direct deposit for unemployment payments. And as you and I have discussed, that went haywire during the pandemic when the state's Bank of America unemployment debit cards proved to be vulnerable to fraud. So the state still doesn't have a direct deposit option. So workers still have to deal with these debit cards. Though interestingly, we also did find out that Bank of America is winding down their work with the state. So there's going to be a new bank in play here. So it just shows all these things are still kind of rippling. And then we can talk about it in more detail. But the EDD is also gearing up to spend $1.2 billion over the next 5 years on fixing some of the things that went really long, really wrong, like the call centers, where as few as 1 in 1,000 people were getting through. So there's a lot to this that the state is promising help is on the way, and we're going to have to stay on that and follow the story.
When you were reading the documents that you requested, I mean, some of them are email exchanges. Was the state or people who were in positions of power, were they aware really from like the start of the state shutting down that there was an issue with EDD?
I mean, it was pretty surreal to go back and read the emails. We all remember, I'm sure, that time just being so crazy. It was like, okay, things are maybe going to shut down for a few days, a few weeks. And you can kind of see the realization of, oh my gosh, this is going to be enormous, like far beyond any projections for job losses in the emails between the people who were in power at the time. So the state's top labor official, Julie Hsu, had emailed the folks at EDD on like March 18th, the day before California shut down, just basically saying, like, is our system ready for this to prevent delays or even a full system crash? And they were optimistic at first. EDD's IT manager wrote back and said, system is performing fantastic on March 19th. And from there, unfortunately, you can just kind of see the dominoes fall. There's a panic about, oh my gosh, we can't even, there's not enough plastic to print the number of unemployment debit cards we're going to need. You start seeing staffers for state legislators writing to the EDD saying, oh my God, we have constituents who are suicidal because they're stuck getting the runaround from EDD about where their money is. You had folks even like in the governor's office emailing for help saying my Social Security number is being stolen to file fraudulently for unemployment benefits. So it really just kind of by going back and looking at those records, you can see behind the scenes how things were kind of coming unglued, which obviously, unfortunately, had pretty devastating real world impacts for a lot of people.
Yeah, it's important to take a look back because that personal toll is still very much felt to this day for a lot of people. During the pandemic, 1 in 8 Californians were impacted by this widespread fraud. Delayed payments, if they happened, weeks, months on end, but bills didn't stop. What did you learn about the consequences that people suffered?
Yeah, I mean, the ripple effects really kind of went off in all different directions. One of the most kind of one of the biggest patterns we kind of saw was the collision of unemployment issues and the state's housing crisis. So you can see that in stories like a construction worker named Danny Ramos, who is down in the San Diego area, and he in his EDD account could see about $8,000 sitting there, but he told a state appeals judge that he never got the debit card to spend the money. So that left him, you know, not having the cash to pay rent when he needed to. So in his case, he ultimately moved. He was like, I need to find a cheaper rental. And he found that across the Mexico border in Tecate, which in his case meant he had to separate from his family. They went to stay with family in another part of the country. Another man I talked with in Fairfield, close to Sacramento, got in a situation where he also never received the benefits he applied for. He said he was accused of fraud. So he ended up draining his 401k, sold the house in Fairfield, and now lives in an RV at a trailer park in Arizona. So you can see kind of how the EDD issues combined with this sort of California exodus conversation that a lot of folks have been having during the pandemic. But I do think it's important to highlight there was also some really intriguing stories of people who decided to fight back. So there's a mother-daughter pair that I interviewed in San Francisco named Maria and Maribel Sanchez. Maria is from El Salvador and had been a nanny in San Francisco for many years. And when things shut down, obviously that work kind of disappeared being in someone else's home. And so she's most comfortable speaking Spanish and just had a really hard time getting through to the EDD to get her payments and get clarity on her case. And she ultimately was ordered to repay over $2,000 in benefits after the EDD said that she made a, quote, false statement in English, which, again, she's a Spanish speaker. And her daughter Maribel was actually a law student at the time. And she said, this is not fair. There's all this fraud, these scams happening, and the EDD is going after people like my mom who don't have this money to repay them in the first place, and they're not offering them services in the language that they speak. So you can really look at this through so many different lenses, and it's just been wild to kind of see how these stories have unfolded over the last 3 years.
I mean, one of the most extreme cases that you share in your reporting is a gentleman named Shane. He was 28 years old. How did you find out about his story?
Yeah, so Shane he grew up in Garden Grove. He was a surfer. He was a car fanatic. And I found out about his story because his mom unfortunately posted a memorial about him on Facebook. And what happened for Shane is that his traveling sales job, obviously travel completely shut down in March 2020. So that job disappeared with pandemic shutdown orders, and he applied for unemployment. And again, one of these cases where we have screenshots on his phone, it shows he had $11,700 sitting in that account. But he told friends and family he couldn't get the money. And they later saw the call logs. He was just calling EDD dozens of times. You can see it's like 8 a.m., 8.01 a.m., 8.02 a.m., just trying over and over to get through, again, at a time when we know as few as 1 in 1,000 people were getting through on those EDD lines. And ultimately what happened in Shane's case is that 3 days after his mom found out he had just called the EDD 17 times in a row, she got a call at 4 o'clock in the morning from Shane's wife, and Shane had died by suicide. And I do think it's important to note here that experts say suicide is almost always caused by multiple factors. But in Shane's case, his family does think that the inability to fix this problem with the EDD. They said he's a natural born problem solver. So that really frustrated him. Obviously, the financial stress of bills mounting at that time, he was kind of the breadwinner for him and his wife at the time. And then he was also concerned about just like the broader chaotic state of the world. So again, it's not like you can say the EDD was the only factor here, but I think it is just kind of like a really visceral reminder of the impact that all of this had on individual families, because it's something that the Balog family in Orange County is still trying to process today. And Shane's dad, Glenn, said to me, you know, people needed help and my son needed help. And I asked him what he would say to the EDD. And he said, you failed him. And that's something that we can't get back.
Well, you did speak, as you mentioned, with Shane's parents, Patty and Glenn. So let's take a listen to some of the ordeal that they shared with you about what their son endured.
He had called him 17 times in a row. 17. Because I know the office opens at 8. He would be calling at 7:45, 7:50, over and over again. He didn't want to bother anybody with any of his dilemmas, any of his problems. Which is why when we would ask him, hey, do you need money? And he'd say, no, I'm good, really. I'm good, Mom and Dad. I said, okay.
My son couldn't get what he needed to survive, which he paid into. He was owed that. And he wasn't trying to be fraudulent. And he was honest.
Yeah, and Lauren, I mean, this story, Shane's story and his family's story, and also just the other several others that you spoke with, they really capture how this wasn't just simply a grave inconvenience.
No, this was really, you know, I mean, in Shane's case, ultimately a matter of life and death, unfortunately. And I do think it's important to note also, there are no official estimates for how many people died by suicide while they were unemployed during COVID. But we did find out that EDD phone operators have to report any violent threats from callers. And they did record 483 threats of self-harm, and also more than 670 threats against EDD staff. So I think when you hear numbers like that, yes, there were millions of claims coming in at the time, but for the hundreds of people that were able to get through on the phone lines, and these are the sentiments they express, I think it just shows how dire the situation was.
Yeah, I mean, I think a lot of people would have this question. I mean, money was obviously going out, right? Because there were tens of billions of dollars in suspected fraud that took place. It's one of the largest widespread frauds in U.S. history, but it just wasn't going to the right people. So how were scammers more successful than real workers to get these benefits?
Yeah, it's a great question. It's kind of the central question of this entire thing, right? And the answer is that the fraud was extremely confusing. It was a whole web of fraud. It wasn't just like one type of scam that was happening. You had amateur scammers like teenagers and people all over the place that were buying and selling stolen data on the internet, on either the dark web or social media. You have more sophisticated scammers, like Nigeria is one country that analysts have said there's a lot of activity originated from, and there's a lot of court cases there now where folks were using stolen American identities to file claims using like fake Gmail accounts in one court case. And then the highest level, the FBI is still investigating cases where hackers affiliated with foreign governments were hacking in and filing these claims for both unemployment benefits and other types of pandemic relief, like the PPP business loans, you might remember. So it was this very chaotic picture, and how that played out in California, we now know, thanks to reports by people like Jennifer Palka, who co-led a task force convened by the governor to just understand what was happening at EDD. And what they found was that about 60% of the unemployment claims, the millions and millions of claims that were flying in to California, just sailed through this automated process. And that included a lot of claims that later turned out to be fraudulent. And it's interesting because the way that happened is that the good scammers are essentially, they're using stolen personal data that, even if it is checked against like the Social Security database or other things, it's going to pass that check because it's a precise copy of stolen data. They're often using software to kind of auto file these claims. So they got through no problem. But meanwhile, when you have real people that are using like mobile phones or old websites to file their own claims, 40% of them got flagged for all different reasons. Like maybe you put in your middle initial instead of your real middle name, or maybe your last name or your address was too long to fit in the EDD's database. You could have had mismatched dates compared to what your employer said. So the bigger picture is that this all just kind of went completely sideways as claims flooded in. And the big variable here that the EDD stresses is that there was this emergency program created for self-employed workers. It was called the Pandemic Unemployment Assistance Program, or PUA, if you've heard that referenced. And EDD now says that's where 95% of the fraud was centered. And those are the ones where the application was not checked against anything else. You didn't have to submit other documents at the time. So those just kind of fly through the process. And meanwhile, folks who were trying to, you know, like cross their T's, dot their I's, were getting held up for all these other reasons. So I know it's a lot, but that's what we now know about just sort of one line of people going straight through the process, no problem, and others getting held up and in some cases facing these really tough circumstances.
You're listening to Insight here on CAP Radio. And if you're just joining us, I'm talking with Lauren Hepler, an investigative reporter for Cal Matters, about her latest investigation into California's unemployment disability agency, EDD. So this all comes as you are writing that EDD is now working on an ambitious new plan to overhaul its benefit systems. What's happening with that? It's $1.2
billion. Yeah, $1.2
billion.
It's a 5-year plan, and it is technically called EDD Next. And the idea, the Ron Hughes, who's hired to be the director, he's a former tech consultant, former state tech official. He said the idea is really to go beyond what the EDD was doing during the pandemic, which was just, you know, trying to stop the bleeding, patch holes with all of the tech contracts they were signing. And now they're trying to step back, stop putting Band-Aids on stuff, and fix some of these systems that they know were really problematic. State audits have made it very clear that the call centers that I mentioned were an issue, the online applications for an issue. They're even going back and looking at changing the questions that folks are asked when they apply for unemployment to make it easier and less confusing. So all of this is in motion now, and the state has already signed a few multi-million-dollar contracts for technology from companies like Salesforce and Amazon to help with some of this. And some of it's live already. There's a new online system called MyEDD where folks can file their claim and sort of track their payment history online. The call center upgrades should be rolling out at the end of this year and next summer. So that's sort of still to come. And I would say the gist I'm getting from folks is that they're They're hopeful, but a bit wary given the EDD's history.
Yeah. Okay. So $1.2 billion over 5 years. So that leads to my next question. What do you want someone to know if they have to file for unemployment or disability tomorrow? I mean, what should they know?
It's a good question. I asked the EDD that, and like their message is kind of like, hold tight, we're fixing this. So that does leave the question of what do you do in the meantime? So, I mean, I talked with a lot of folks who are still, even like one woman who was trying to file for disability over the summer. She said she was still calling up to 67 times a day. You know, it's still getting kind of the runaround that we heard about with the unemployment system. And folks take different approaches. A fair number of people I talk with have reached directly out to their state assembly or state senator and gotten help that way. Some folks reach out to people in the media, like you or me, Vicky, to just try to share their story. There's all kinds of communities online, on Reddit, on Facebook, on YouTube, where people share tips about how to crack through the phone system and things like that. So it still is kind of a disjointed picture. And I think there's a lot riding on these upgrades.
Well, Lauren, thank you so much for the investigative series.
Thank you for having me.
Lauren Hepler is an investigative reporter for Cal Matters, and we've been talking about her latest investigations into the pandemic failures of California's unemployment agency, EDD, as well as a new plan to overhaul its systems. Still ahead, the Sacramento Observer is celebrating 60 years. We're going to revisit my conversation about the Observer's history. You're listening to Insight here on CAP Radio. I'm your host, Vicky Gonzalez. We're back in just a moment. Welcome back to Insight on CAP Radio. I'm your host, Vicky Gonzalez. The Sacramento Observer is celebrating a big milestone on Friday with a 60th anniversary gala celebration. And there's a rich history to becoming one of the leading African-American newsrooms in the country. We here at CAP Radio actually have a unique partnership with the Sac Observer. Our newsrooms share Sacramento education reporter Shrishti Prabha, who covers K-12 schools, as part of Report for America, a national program that places journalists into local newsrooms to report on undercovered issues and communities. This summer, I sat down with Larry Lee, the president and publisher of The Observer, about his family's contribution over the decades. So we're going to get to these big accomplishments in just a moment, but let's just start with the Sacramento Observer itself. It has such a rich history in our community that really begins with your family. You grew up with really understanding the power of local journalism. Why did your father start The Observer?
Oh, I think, and I don't want to forget the other two gentlemen, Gino Gladden and John Cole, who were right alongside of him, as well as the families, the wives that were there as well, too, that helped start the paper. It was really out of a need for, the community, the African-American community having a voice. You're talking about 1962. The African-American experience was not necessarily documented anywhere else. And, you know, you're in the midst of, you know, civil rights, you know, period. And so there was a publication that preceded The Observer called The Sacramento Outlook. It was more of a religious publication, wasn't printed with the frequency of a regular newspaper. And so these three decided to start it. The responsibility of it fell quickly to my family as Gino Gladden passed away pretty early and John Cole was kind of like a serial businessman. And so he would have, you know, lots of different business ideas and ventures. So my dad took to it pretty quickly in November of 62 after they started. And really within 10 years, he had really catapulted the Observer into, you know, the upper echelon of the Black press, which historically has, you know, quite an amazing legacy. It's the nation's first Black business and has been responsible for countless achievements and changes for the African-American community across the country. And he just dove right into that legacy and that history and never really looked back.
Was entering journalism, running the Sac Observer as you do now, was that knee-jerk for you? Is that something you always wanted to do?
You know, the funny thing, I will say this much, is I am a very appreciative of, I'm the youngest of three boys. I was born in 1973, which was actually the first year that The Observer ever was named the nation's best black newspaper. I teasingly told my dad it wasn't until I was born that The Observer really started to do to start winning great awards. But, you know, I think the thing that I would say that my parents gave me, you know, pretty young is it gave me purpose. So I was very... very aware of what The Observer was doing for the African-American community on a week-in, week-out basis of through the print product of the newspaper. I was fortunate enough to have gone to San Jose State during the midst of the Silicon Valley growth and everything there. And so I was paying attention very early, 18, 19 years old, of what does media look like? What is a local community newspaper? How does it survive? How does it grow? You know, what are some of the things that we can do with technology to kind of bolster our audience and reach them where they are? And so so that purpose that they gave me when, and I say they gave me purpose because they literally asked me, do you want to have anything to do with the family business when I was about 18 years old? I think they were in their own season trying to decide whether or not they were going to hold on to it or sell it or whatever they might do. And, you know, I so the knee jerk reaction was me saying yes, not really knowing everything that I was getting myself into.
And then figuring it out.
And then figuring it out. Absolutely. But I absolutely love the work that we do. And I told someone the other day, I was born in the black press and I will die in the black press.
You know, given that The Observer has been around for over 60 years, I would imagine this paper has weathered, you know, quite a few storms to still be relevant and still be impactful today. How has The Observer grown and what challenges did it have to overcome?
Oh, gosh. You know, the first of all, the challenge of being a family business in and of itself is a challenge. The challenge of being, you know, an African-American black-owned business is very challenging. And then you throw in there the news industry and the challenges that it has faced. So, you know, challenges come every day, it seems like. I think what, you know, I learned is that they are just challenges. And sometimes they're opportunities to kind of show what you can do. And I think that, you know, I personally have developed, I believe, a really strong tolerance for really difficult times and being able to kind of keep my eye very focused on what we're trying to do. I say often that God has given us vision and provision. He's given us, and I say us, I'm saying collectively me, but he's given us a direction of what we want to do to help serve this community. That's really where it comes from, too, is knowing the conditions that African Americans are faced with each and every day, that gives us such great motivation to help serve that community in the best way possible. The gift that I've been given is the work of The Observer and the tools of how do we do that through journalism and community engagement and, you know, all the other different ways in which you amplify the challenges as well as the joys of our community, which there's so many things that often just get overlooked by mainstream press. And that's why we're here. And so, you know, we've had difficult financial times, staffing challenges. It's just all, you know, advertising challenges, the change of technology, all those things have hit us. But we just kind of put our head down and stay very focused and committed to what we're doing each and every day.
Yeah. And this year is a good year to kind of pat yourselves on the back because you just received the best black newspaper in the nation. Tell us about this award since it's the seventh time The Observer has received it.
Sure. So NNPA, the National Newspaper Publishers Association, of which we're a member, is kind of what we would call the black press of America. There's about 200 black newspapers across the country. Some of them are in communities that are very underserved, rural communities and the like. But some of them are in major metropolitan, what we would call chocolate cities. You know, we have a story online right now about the blackest cities in the United States and cities like Detroit and Baltimore, where there's 60-70% African-American population. You know, so the NNPA really are Black Press Awards are kind of like our Pulitzers. It's where they judge all of our work over the last year or so. Now, The Observer honestly has not entered the competition. We have not entered the competition in 20 years. 2003 was the last time we entered. In the last 30 years, we've only entered twice.
Why?
In all honesty, I think a lot of it was, so there's a couple of things. One, if you, in our business, it's kind of hard pulling all the entries together.
It is a lot of work.
When you're a weekly newspaper, you have to literally go through every publication, every story, and kind of look at it with a critical eye. And there's been times when we just didn't have the bandwidth to do it. It just didn't. We had, for the better part of the last 15 years, we've been, kind of a very small staff. And so, the time and dedication on kind of pulling those together was time consuming. I will say, however, I was very motivated and have been very motivated the last couple of years because we have made some tremendous progress as an organization. And I really wanted to highlight the work that we've been doing. And so, pulling the entries together was something that we were very focused on doing this year. We entered there's 23 total categories. We entered 18 of the categories. Of the 18, we were awarded in 14. And then, unbeknownst to me, the publishers named me Publisher of the Year. And I was...
This keeps getting better.
It was, and that comes about 30 days after we were acknowledged and recognized by the California Newspaper Publishers Association as the third best weekly in the state of California. And to us, that was very significant because there are communities in California, as you know, that, have really struggled with news as news deserts. And so the weeklies tend to be, in some communities, the primary publication of that community. And for CNPA to recognize a niche publication like ours, where African-Americans can get around their life without the Observer each and every day. But the fact that they recognize kind of our high impact journalism in particular that we've been doing over the last couple of years was confirmation about, what we're doing as an organization.
Yeah. And it's really difficult when the only constant to journalism, regardless the medium, is change.
Yes.
And often doing more with less. Given that other news outlets in recent years, they've been starting to invest in DEI beats, which is diversity, equity, inclusion, mm-hmm. Race and culture reporters. What is your view on that?
I think it's important. I think communities are better when local newsrooms are healthy and are investing and reporting on the entire community. I don't think people say, well, does that mean that there's still relevance to the Black press? I feel like there's always going to be relevance to the Black press. I think no matter what the work is that other newsrooms do related to race and culture and the work that they're doing, they should do it because they're also reaching an audience that we are might not be reaching. And so that community needs to be informed of those issues. But I will say that our reporting is unique. Our perspective is unique. Our connection with the community is unique. The voices that we include in our publication are unique. And so there's just some nuances that we have when we cover our community week in, week out for 60 years. But I applaud newsrooms that have that and use that as, a guiding light within their newsroom. I want to make sure that they continue with that effort because it was in fashion after George Floyd, and it needs to continue. And so I would urge them to continue to do that and then to create partnerships like with newsrooms like ours as well, too, because I think that's important.
Yeah, we're better in numbers.
Absolutely.
And when we work together. Larry, thank you so much for the time.
Thank you for having me.
Larry Lee is the president and publisher of the Sacramento Observer, sharing the history of becoming one of the leading African-American newsrooms in the country. They're celebrating the paper's 60th anniversary gala celebration tomorrow. The Sac Observer and Cap Radio have a unique partnership with Report for America. It is a national program that places journalists into local newsrooms to report on undercovered issues and communities. Our newsroom share Sacramento education reporter Shrishti Prabha, who covers K-12 schools. My conversation with Larry first aired in July. And that is it for Insight today. You can learn more about our guests at capradio.org/insight. You can also subscribe to the Insight podcast. If you want to join the conversation, email us at insight@capradio.org. Thank you to producer Sarit Lashinsky and managing editor Aram Sarkissian. Our digital producer is Claire Morgan. Insight's technical director and engineer is Mark Jones. Our show music is produced by Adrian Gilmore. And I'm Vicky Gonzalez. Thanks for joining us. Have a great weekend. We'll catch you back here on Monday.